Okay, we want to now talk about, we're now on the point in the outline, we're still under literal. We haven't gotten to the question of canonization yet. We're still talking about literal, and we're going to talk about that at a little bit of length. So you may even want to turn the page over or do whatever is necessary to make some room to take some notes on these viewpoints. In the view of Duane Garrett, and I think in my view as well, the best approach to the interpretation of this song is to see it not only as speaking of as taking some literal view, but of seeing it as a unified love song. Now, there are other approaches that would see this as an anthology, a collection of love poetry, without any kind of storyline whatsoever. Not much of a progression in the book at all. But if we can find a progression there, I prefer to do that. And it does seem to hang together. This approach has been viewed, the literal approach, the love song approach, has been viewed as the best interpretation for some long time, beginning with Rabbi Akiba and then also Josephus in the early Christian centuries, Theodore of Mopsuestia, I will not ask this on the test, and the Antiochene school. The Antiochene school was given to literal biblical interpretation, and so naturally they gravitated in this direction. Now, taking this literal approach does not mean, let me emphasize, it does not mean that we take what is clearly symbolic or figurative and interpret that literally. What this is a love poem using metaphor, but it is literally a love poem, a poem about the love between a man and a woman, and particularly the poem between the love between a bride and her groom, or a wife and her husband, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. For instance, just to take an example, if you look in Song of Songs, chapter 3, beginning in verse 6, we have that episode where the question is asked, "Who is coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense made from all the spices of the merchant? Look! It is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him, on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced." On the day of his wedding. Well, who is he? Well, which day of his wedding? If we're talking about the literal Solomon, it's the question. Duane Garrett's approach, and again, I find this attractive, is to see this Solomonic character as indeed a symbol of the groom. Or again, in chapter 6, beginning in verse 10, we read this. "Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars in procession? I went down to the grove of nut trees to look at the new growth in the valley, to see if the vines had budded or the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people." Now that verse, 6:12, is probably the most difficult verse to translate in the entire book, and I'll tell you the options in just a second. "Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people. Come back, O Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze on you." Now, who is the Shulamite? Commentators have searched in vain to find a place, Shulam, that would explain this particular reference. And so the more attractive, to me at least, renderings are to say, if Solomon is used symbolically for the groom, then what might be the symbol for the bride, if not in Hebrew, Shulamit is like Solomoness. Okay? Solomoness, the queenly figure. If the groom is the kingly figure, she is the queenly figure. And you can see the relationship between Shlomo and Shulamit. So that may help to explain. I said that earlier that 6:12 is one of the more difficult verses, and probably the most difficult verse to translate in the book. In addition to what you read in the NIV, which was, "Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots," another translation, a Roman Catholic translation, says this, "Before I knew it, my heart had made me the blessed one of my kinswomen." Okay, you see how widely different the translation can be of the same Hebrew. And also remember that Hebrew is made up of consonants and vowels, as with most languages, but the consonants were original. It's a language that's written without vowels, sort of like vanity license tags. Often you can read them, even though the vowels are often left out. You can still read them if you know English. Well, Hebrew was written that way originally, and then the vowel points were put in later. And so if we talk about the inspired text, we're talking about the consonants, not so much the vowels. So sometimes with the change of a vowel, you change the word and thus change the meaning. The Revised Standard Version says, "Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince." Okay, now this is what Barry Webb picks up on in his notion of a dream sequence taking place. "Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince." Okay, not that the bride has actually found her way into the actual chariots of Solomon, but rather in her fancy, and there's a debate as to whether this should be the groom or the bride speaking at this particular point. One other suggestion is, and this is Garrett's suggestion, with a slight emendation to the text, "I am beside myself, you have set me among chariots, a prince is with me." So again, that would fit the notion that this is a literal and yet figurative love song, love poem, between a man and a woman, a groom and his bride, a husband and his wife. Now, one reason that it's probably best to view it as a unified love song and not an anthology is the structure of the book. You see the handout I gave you that looks rather amazing? This one here, you see this rather amazing handout? This is from a commentary. I'm not sure whether this commentary has yet appeared by Robert Alden. Robert Alden died last year, sadly, as a very fine man who taught out at Denver Seminary, Old Testament scholar. But what you have here is one of those magnificent, cleverly devised chiasms. This is a chiasm that is based on key words. Now, whether this was fully intentional by the author is hard to say, but it is at least very, very interesting that you do see the repetition of keywords in a rather orderly sequence, beginning one place and then coming full circle. And at the very center of this chiasm, 4:16 and 5:1, in Duane Garrett's view, and I think this makes a lot of sense, you have the actual consummation of the marriage, where this garden imagery, which represents really the bodies of the two individuals, the invitations, the longing to enter the garden has been present. But now at this time, in 4:16 and 5:1, into the garden is what we read in 4:16. "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." And then the groom responds, "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh and my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk." All of these in the perfect tense, in the past tense. I have done this. The marriage, on this view, is consummated at this time. Now, that's an interesting approach. This structure is interesting. It might be worth some reflection. Check it out. Look and see if you believe that Robert Alden has perhaps been very selective in what he's chosen to find in the various verses. You know, if you've got thousands of items from which to choose and he manages to find three that are parallel, that would not be convincing. But I don't think that's the case. I think this is... I'd look forward to the full publication of his commentary so I can read his explanation of this. But this was from Duane Garrett's commentary. He apparently had this in advance of the publication of that commentary. So, a literal poem, a unified poem, a poem that uses much imagery. It's imagery that was enjoyed in an ancient context, but it often places considerable distance between the image and the reality depicted. Nevertheless, despite that, the early poets achieved a high degree of tenderness and even sensuality without the eroticism that sterilizes, in Garrett's words, modern love poetry. Through simile and metaphor, even the strongest and most private of emotions of sexual love can be expressed in a way that is tasteful, appropriate, and descriptive. All this reading about gardens and such is wonderful, is alluring, and yet not highly descriptive. The groom is described as king. Elsewhere, he's described as shepherd on this view. These are poetic symbols in the Song of Songs. And such symbols are typical in ancient Near Eastern love poetry. An Egyptian man may be symbolized as a bird catcher or the doorkeeper in the woman's home. Not literally probably a bird catcher or a doorkeeper, but these are symbols that had some meaning at that time. So this is a celebration. This book is a celebration, I think, of human love, physical love. And yet, as Brevard Childs points out, this is not simply a celebration of human love in and of itself or for its own sake, but rather this is a celebration of human love within the marriage context. Now, what would lead us to think this? Chapter 3, verse 11. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Explicit reference to the wedding. The king is introduced as the lover who seeks his bride at near that center of the book when I mentioned earlier the consummation of the marriage takes place at the end of chapter 4. Notice leading up to that, the repetition of bride in 4:9. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. Now again, the sister is a term of endearment in the ancient Near East. I would not refer necessarily to the woman who's to become my wife as my sister. That's just not something that we would typically do, but it's typical for them. So that's a term of endearment, but bride is not. As far as we know, bride is never used in that sort of casual, informal sense, but it rather is referring to her as literally his bride. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden, locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes, and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. Now, after that identification, you are the garden. Then, when she says, let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits, and he says, I have come into my garden, then surely we recognize here that this is the consummation of that marriage. Now, it is, however, having said all that, it is frequently asserted that the song, not all that convincingly, but sometimes you can pick up articles or books that will assert that this song is a celebration of human love per se. And I could alert you to some articles that even think that this is a celebration of unmarried teenage love. But don't buy that. As Brevard Childs says, nowhere is human love in itself celebrated in wisdom literature, nor in the whole of the Old Testament for that matter. Wisdom, not love, is divine. Yet love between a man and a woman is an inextinguishable force within human experience, strong as death, which the sage seeks to understand. The writer simply assumes the Hebrew order of the family as part of the given order of his society and seeks to explore and unravel its mysteries from within. To think otherwise, to suggest that this is actually a celebration of unmarried premarital sex between teenagers is ridiculous in the light of the canon of Scripture. How in the world would that have found a place in ancient Israelite society, much less in their holy book? So we are to assume the institution of marriage. We are to assume these references to the bride and so forth are references to a marital situation. Now, one other question that we've alluded to that needs to be addressed to some extent is this question of two lovers or three. Are we dealing with a love triangle? Are we dealing with the country maiden, the shepherd lover, and Solomon, the intrusive, jaded king who wants to add yet one more to his harem? I have read some fairly convincing, dramatic, three-party interpretations of the book. One of the most convincing that I have heard is from my own pastor here, Rodney Stortz, at Twin Oaks Presbyterian Church. He can do about as well as any I've heard at explaining the text passage by passage according to that view. And so I wouldn't want to sweep it aside as not a possibility. It does, however, sort of change the nature of the book. It becomes more of a morality play, extolling the virtues of pure, pristine love. And it becomes a rather poignant drama as, according to that view, the young woman is actually brought into the court of Solomon and seduced by him. Now, again, I'm not fully convinced that I can find that comfortably in the text, but that argument can be made. I guess in the end, it might be fair to say, as Jacob Fishman says of this particular book, that anyone for whom this poetry has become a part of his soul does not really need to know precisely whether it is an idyllic epic, an anthology of folk songs, or a dramatic play. He tastes in it the flavor of all the poetic genres of love. Now that may be an escape route, but maybe that's what we need to say if we can't be certain. I'm attracted to this, and of course the last thing you read is what you're most attracted to sometimes, but I'm attracted to Duane Garrett's view, which sees this as a celebration of marriage, the consummation of that marriage taking place in the beginning of the book, and thus there is some progress. While not quite a narrative, not quite a plot, there is a progression from desire to marriage, consummation, and so forth. And so I want to talk a bit more as we come to later in just a second to key verses and questions. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about his interpretation and talk about who the watchers of the city gates are in his interpretation, which is, again, another major problem in the book. What about the question of canonization? Next item on your outline. As I mentioned before, one of the older views was that it was the allegorical interpretation that allowed the book to find its way into the canon. Brevard Childs argues that the song entered the canon in essentially the same role as it had played in Israel's institutional life. It celebrated the mysteries of human love expressed in the marriage festival. I like that better. I prefer to say the human condition remains the same. We need a song like this to tell us that sexuality, devoted, monogamous human love is God's idea, and it's good. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's something that we should celebrate. And I think they needed that then, and we need it now. Yes, question. Right, yeah, great question. The question is, if Solomon is the author, how in the world could he write a book that celebrates committed, marital, self-giving love when, in fact, he had taken 1,000 times, 700 wives and 300 concubines, even allowing for round numbers there. That's a lot of women that he had taken into his life and into his court. How could Solomon have done this? Well, there's a difference between knowing and doing. We often say better than we do. I'm not, in a sense, maybe from that side of things, he was able to see more clearly the rightness of the path which perhaps he had not followed. Again, I'm not real interested in defending Solomon as necessarily the author. But if he is the author, and in order to explain that would be the direction I would take it. How could he write the book of Proverbs, where he does seem quite clearly to be the author of the bulk of that book? How could he write such words of practical wisdom and yet do such impractical things and end his life in such misery, as he apparently did if we read his story in 1 Kings 1 to 11? Again, he asked God for a discerning heart, a clever mind. God gave it to him. He used his clever mind, but he didn't always go by his own, he didn't always follow his own advice, apparently. And so incrementally, his life was basically unraveled. Yes, Dave. Yeah, the question is, and it was couched in more sophisticated terms than I'm going to be able to repeat, but is it not possible that this could have been Solomon in one of his very first experience or one of his very first wives? I think the problem, and I'm sorry I can't put my finger on the verse immediately, but there is a mention in this one of the Solomon passages. What is it? 6:8. It's good to have someone up front who has it all memorized. 6:8. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. Well, if that is Solomon speaking, and if he's speaking about his own harem, it's already, taking shape. But that may not, you know, that may not be the final answer. But that's what would caution me against taking that view. Okay, well, purpose of the book, canonization of the book. I think it was canonized pretty much as we're trying to read it here, as a celebration of the value, the power, and the rightness of human love. As Duane Garrett puts it in his commentary, love and sexuality can be a source of great joy or of deep grief and pain. And he goes on to make this practical observation. As children become adults and discover their sexuality, and as couples move into marriage and seek to understand each other, it is imperative that they have guidance in this area of life that is so crucial to psychological adjustment. In other words, he sees the purpose of this book as something to train the young and to instruct those entering into marriage, and I think to inspire those of us who are already married, that this is right and good under God's guidance and according to His instructions. This is something that we should celebrate. Well, let's look at some key verses and questions. And the first one, I want you to just think about this, and maybe I'm going to even ask you to take about 5 minutes max just to talk to the person next to you. What do you think about the charge that is given for the first time and then repeated two more times in the book of in this book, the charge that is given in 2:7? Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. I want you to think about that, talk about it. We're just going to take 5 minutes. You can turn the tape off for 5 minutes. This is not a group interaction exactly. It's just, you know, the person next to you. Find where that is repeated. It's two more times. And then think about what might that mean. Okay, 5 minutes max. What do you think? Who wants to volunteer an interpretation? I'd like to come up with more than one. What do you think that means? By the way, where did they occur? 2:7? 3:5? 8:4. Very good. Those three. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Any other translations first off? Until it pleases. That's maybe a little more interesting because it's a little more ambiguous, isn't it? Until it pleases. Okay, good. Who wants to give an interpretation? What do you think this means? What is being enjoined here? Yeah, Brian? Okay. Okay, good. The charge, wonderfully put. I wish you were mic'd. The charge, you know, where it says, I adjure you, I charge you by the gazelles and the does of the field, those things that are free, those things that are graceful. Now, there's also the possibility of an allusion to a divine name there, and you can get all that discussion in the commentaries. But I like this approach better, which you're not the first to say that, but that's well put. Charged by that which is free and graceful, not to arouse or awaken love until the profitable time, until the appropriate time. There's a time that it's too early to open up what is a wonderful thing in the right context. When I was a teenager, I heard the example of, having sod out on the lawn, which is beautiful and lush and perfect in its place. Bring it in and put it on your new carpet. We had shag rugs in that ancient time. Bring in a piece of sod and lay it out on your carpet, and it's dirt, and it's bad, and you have to get it out of there, put it in its right place, and it's wonderful and it's appropriate. And that stuck with me, I guess, because I just repeated it. As an example of the way we should view sexuality, which is a God-given gift, and we need to use it in a God-given context. Other interpretations, you might guess, I like that one. That's the direction I think this probably should go. But yes, Linda? Okay, good. Again, I wish that I had a mic to mic these answers so I don't have to struggle to try to repeat them as well. But reading on in these verses, the point being made here is that there's the arrival of spring, there's the arrival of the time of love, sort of the mating season in terms of the cycles of nature, which may imply that yes, there's an appropriate time even in human relationships for the expression of this kind of physical love between a man and his wife. Yeah, I think that works as well. Both kind of talking about the appropriate time, the profitable time, the time that pleases, that is pleasing, and that is and pleases the situation. It not only pleases the participants, but it's the pleasing time. The Hebrew there could be read the profitable time, when it can go somewhere. I know all of you, most of you, are too young to have teenage children, but I have a teenage son who really broke up with his girlfriend at one point because he wisely, I believe, realized there's no place for this to go. You know, I'm too young. We're developing this relationship that really can't go anywhere. You know, not just physically, but I'm talking about even emotionally becoming knit together with that person, you know, in the ninth grade. And they both kind of decided that this was not smart, you know, that there's just the appropriate time. It was not the time that pleased. And so there is a value in deferring. Now, there are other views out there, and you need to know that. Marcia Falk has written a very interesting kind of book on this song. She believes it's an anthology of love songs, individual love songs, I think 30 of them, 31 of them or something. And she basically takes the approach that this is, say, basically putting the do not disturb sign on the door. You know, do not arouse or awaken love. In other words, don't disturb us until we're ready for you to disturb us. I'm not as convinced by that as you might well imagine. Any other suggestions that you came up with, or did you all move in the right direction? I think, you know, it's not as plain as day that that's the way to take it, but I think in the context, and particularly as these interpretations develop, I think that makes the best sense. That she, the bride, who is, as you, I hope you noticed, the dominant voice. The woman is the dominant voice in this love song. Love is not just something, and physical love is not just something of interest to men, and it's sad when it becomes that. She is quite interested in it, and even quite aggressive about it. She's the dominant voice, and she says to her friends, to the chorus, do not arouse or awaken love until the appropriate time. It's worth the wait. Well, another question, the other one that I have on your outline, is this issue that's introduced in the first five verses of chapter 3. We'll just read the first one. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. How did Barry Webb interpret that verse, and then really all of 3 to 6, chapters 3 to 6, as a dream sequence? And you know, that does kind of resolve a lot of difficulties very quickly, if that's what's going on, because, you know, in dreams a lot of very, very strange things happen. And if that's what's going on, then this sort of surrealistic going out into the city and encountering the watchers of the city gate and even being stripped and beaten by the watchers of the city gate, well, if that happened in a dream, it's not quite as horrendous, maybe. I mean, dreams are horrendous, but at least we awaken out of them, as it would be if it happened in reality, literally. So there's some force to this. Perhaps even stronger is 5:2, where he says, where she says, the beloved says, the woman says, I slept, but my heart was awake. And then it goes into that fairly well-known passage. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. And she says in verse 3, I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I... You know, that doesn't sound like this woman of passion that we've been reading about in the rest of the book. You know, I don't want to get my feet dirty. I'm not sure where my slippers are. So it would make somewhat more sense. And I was initially quite attracted to the view that this is a dream sequence, and that may still be the case. Now, again, I told you I was going to be kind of contrasting Webb and Garrett. Dwayne Garrett does offer a different suggestion, and he's not wild about the dream interpretation. He thinks that the dream interpretation becomes meaningless. I'm not sure he's right about that, and I'm not sure that you can't combine what I'm about to report that he says and the dream interpretation. But his view is this. He says that what we have again here is symbolism. These events are symbolic, and specifically they signify this strange episode beginning in 3 and then also in 5, noticing that this is really framing the consummation of the marriage. Remember, the consummation takes place at the end of 4 and the first verse of chapter 5. So more or less framing that are these rather curious episodes. He suggests that this symbolizes the woman's anxiety first at the approach of her loss of virginity to her husband. Let me explain, because that's kind of strikingly strange when you first say it. But he says, for instance, that the allusions to wandering in the streets refer to her desire to go out and draw her husband, to attract her groom, you know, in anticipation of his becoming her husband. But she encounters the guardians of the city. Now again, he says this is metaphorical language, imagistic language, signifying her virginity. She is protected by authority. She's protected by that sanction, which was very much a part of that biblical culture. And it's a struggle for her, because on the one hand, her virginity is the impediment between her and the man she loves and wants to become one with. But it's also the key to gaining him. It's in the sacrifice of that that she will gain him. And so in anticipation, you have, before the consummation of the marriage, you have those kinds of reflections, that sense of anxiety to the approaching change of her status. And then we have the consummation of the marriage at the end of 4 and the beginning of 5. And then right after that, you know, right after that passage where, you know, she says at the end of 4, "Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits," and he reports that he has now done that. It's right after that, the chorus, the friends say, "Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers." Now, again, this is poetry. We're not to imagine that they were present. Okay, they're not present, they're not participants, they're not spectators. This is poetry, and they are celebrating, just as we celebrate when a close friend finds a great partner and they get married. We go and celebrate with them, and we may even say, "Have a wonderful honeymoon," you know, but we don't go with them on the honeymoon. But that's, the friends are saying, "Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers." And then we have this poem that follows. "I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one." And she first won't get up, and then it says, "My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my lover, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak. Those watchmen of the walls, O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love." Now, that does seem rather strange, but Garrett's interpretation is that this is an image of the woman's sudden sense of isolation. At the very moment of a union, or in the immediate aftermath of that union, there's a sudden sense that she has lost something. Her understanding of her loss of virginity to her lover is nevertheless mixed with feelings of love for him and feelings of deep loss of her life as it once was. She is no longer one of the daughters, one of the maidens of Jerusalem. Her status has changed. And I think that passage is more traumatic for a woman than it is for a man. And because it's traumatic and because it's significant, it's not something to take lightly. Now, we rejoice that we are under grace and God remakes us as new creatures and so forth. But in terms of the sort of general cultural milieu in which we live, we should train our children of the value. We should charge them, even as this beloved charged the daughters of Jerusalem, not to arouse or awaken love until it's pleasing, until it pleases, until the right time. Metaphorically then, Garrett says, it is not any person who assaults her, but it is her own virginity. This is an experience in which the man paradoxically has no part. He can't really identify with that. And so she feels isolated with her feelings at this point. The implication is, I guess I've said that. But look at how it follows. Look at what follows in chapter 6, beginning in verse 4. In this passage, the groom, the husband now, says, "You are beautiful, my darling, as tears, a lovely as Jerusalem, majestic as troops with banners. Turn your eyes from me, they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep coming up from washing. Each has its twin, not one of them is alone. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate." Have we heard that before? Okay, we heard that earlier, and this is sort of a reprise, a reintroduction of all of those images, those metaphors and such, that were used to extol the beauty and the attraction of the bride-to-be. And so now for the groom to reassert them is to imply that his desire for his now wife, and his admiration of her has not diminished now that he has possessed her sexually and they have been joined as one. It's quite different from the reaction of Amnon and Tamar when it says of Amnon being a son of David who violated his half-sister, the sister of Absalom. It says that when he had violated her, his hatred for her was stronger than the love he had felt for her. But here it's the exact opposite. Same physical act in some ways, not the violation aspect, but there was a physical joining. But in the right context, it only builds that sense of wonder and admiration in the heart of the man. In the wrong context, it becomes an act of violence and something that pulls people apart. Well, in summary then, the arrival of the groom, and as we read at the end of the book, the departure with his bride. In this we see in this story as we're reading, we see the arrival of the groom, the departure of the bride, the inner world of the woman's emotional journey, the dialogue with the chorus, the intimacies of the bedroom are all meant to portray the range of emotions and experiences connected with the wedding night. That's sort of Garrett's view in a nutshell, and more or less in his words as I stumblingly and falteringly delivered them. The arrival of the groom, his departure with his bride, the inner world of the woman's emotional journey, the dialogue with the chorus, and the intimacies of the bedroom are all meant to portray the range of emotions and experiences connected with the wedding night. And then when we come to chapter 7, verse 10, we again have the woman speaking, and she says, I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. Come, my lover, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Where have we heard that before? Or something very like that. You don't have to give me chapter and verse. You can say earlier in the book. Okay? Yeah, formerly it was the groom that was inviting his wife, inviting his bride-to-be, I think, at that juncture. In chapter 2, verses 10 to 13, the groom is inviting her to come away with him. And now, in this new estate, this state of mutuality and love and marital love, she is now inviting him away with her. In her surrender of her virginity to him, she has become liberated in love so that she now aggressively speaks of love and calls him to herself. And then in verse 13, it reads, the mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my lover. Just a brief word of personal experience, and I'll begin with Howard Hendricks. Howard Hendricks once referred to his relationship with his wife, particularly the sexual aspect of his relationship with his wife, as a 20-year warm-up. Now, it's a little embarrassing to put this on tape, but do not believe the lie that you're most sexually active, certainly not before marriage or at the beginning of your marriage. Rightly developed sexuality becomes an increasingly wonderful part of marriage over the long term. And I think this verse relates to that when she says, the mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door, remember the door formerly was a barrier. Some people interpret that, you know, we have a sister, if she is a wall, we will build towers on her. If she is a door, they take that as if she's an open door. But really, I think it's proper to see that as if she's a door, we will decorate her with cedar. In other words, it was formerly a barrier, something that was closed. But now notice that the bride refers to our door, and at our door is every delicacy. Now the door is open. And then she says, both new and old. And that is perhaps there's a sense in which, yes, the wonders of marital love that were first experienced will continue to be experienced, but there can be progression of intimacy and understanding between husband and wife over the years. Now, that's best cultivated if it is done carefully, caringly, and not by importing a lot of outside information. I think information is fine, but I think that sometimes, I fear for our children sometimes who are exposed to kinds of depictions of sexuality and even sexual practice that is perhaps wrong in certain contexts, certainly wrong in certain contexts, perhaps not necessarily wrong, but too advanced for them, not something that they should even necessarily know about. at that particular stage, something that would be far better were they to discover down the road. Now, I don't want to get more explicit than that, but I do think that that may be what this is referring to, every delicacy, both new and old. Now, what can we say in conclusion and in discussion? We've got a few minutes. Whatever may be the intricacies and uncertainties in the interpretation of this Song of Songs, it surely sounds forth the joys of love that God makes possible between a man and a woman. It is the love depicted here, and we want to get to that, and you learned it in Webb's essay, the love depicted here is more than physical love, but it is surely not less. The book contains a message that I think our society needs to hear, perhaps our churches need to hear, because the church does, and certainly our society is confused about sexuality. Our church is often ambivalent to the issue, and if I may share a highlight, a rather curious thing, both a bit scary and almost funny at times as well, from this book, Intimate Allies. It talks about the fact that early in the history of the church, a hostile attitude toward sensuality and sexuality infiltrated the Christian community. Celibacy was esteemed and elevated. The great leaders of the early church incarnated this disdain for the flesh in their writings and their lives. Origen, who was an allegorical interpreter of the third century, interpreted the Song of Songs in an allegorical, spiritual manner, in the words of Longman or Allender here, doing to the book the same thing he did to his body. I don't know if you know this horrifying story, when he took a knife and castrated himself. Origen was so confused and conflicted with his own sexuality and his own sexual urges that he felt the best way to purity was simply to remove them, and he did. And in a sense, he does the same thing when he mystifies or allegorizes this book. Now, while not many people take this radical approach to their struggles with lust, others did their best to flee the temptations of sex. Augustine, Saint Augustine, as you know, had a rather sordid early beginning to life. When he converted from a promiscuous lifestyle, he retreated from fleshly contact with the opposite sex. He equated sexuality with his pagan past and decided it was something to avoid. Again, I think that's a problem, and that can happen if we're unable to resolve the wrongs of our past, and yet God can resolve them. I don't think we should simply distance ourselves. Jerome, who was another famous Christian of the 4th and 5th century, would throw himself into thorny brambles so that the pain would overwhelm his desire for the female body. So I guess if he were particularly marked up, you'd know he was going through a rough patch. I don't know. And this is what I really love. This is what I really love. It says, when this method failed him, it is said that he took up the study of Hebrew. Apparently that managed to distract him from his sexual thoughts. I don't know. Well, another thing, let me just say a few more things. Another thing that they mention here is that many of the first leaders of the church converted to Christianity from Greco-Roman paganism. And as you know, paganism, associated with Platonism, often drove a wedge between the body and the soul, the flesh and the spirit. And the flesh was regarded as bad. But now that's paganism. That's not biblicism. That's not the Bible. The Old Testament makes it clear that human beings are whole beings. God gave Adam and Eve bodies. And that was before the fall. And he looked at them and said, this is very good. The flesh is good, rightly employed. Allender and Longman point out that Plato's spirit, however, still hovers over the church, denigrating the body and its sensual delights. And they say, if you fall in line with this, if you think in these ways, it says, if your thinking reflects any of these hesitations, your world is about to be shaken to the core by the Bible. Certainly the Scripture does not advocate or permit an unbridled sensuality, but it encourages a delight in sensual intimacy within the bounds of marriage. And that, I think, is the message that we need to portray, because, you know, we're regarded by our world as prudes who have lost out on life and have no fun. I had a friend that I worked with when I was newly married, or about to be married actually, down in Atlanta when I was working construction, and I would witness to him from time to time, and he had a little acquaintance with Christianity, but he said, "I have a clear choice, and I can't choose Christ because I'm too attracted to women." And he was a real good looking guy. This was an apartment complex. There were a lot of divorcees, and there were women in his life at lunchtime, you know. But if I knew what I know now, I would have said, if sex meaningful to you, then turn to Christ so that you can really enjoy it. Because I fear to think what he may be, where he may be now. Now, Webb, I said I'd get back to Webb, and we'll do this before we stop. Webb skillfully shows that the love depicted in this Song of Songs is, yes, physical love, but it's more than that. It's not less, but it is a multidimensional kind of love we hear here. Do you remember, did you catch the three aspects of love that he highlights toward the end of that essay? What are they? What is the love depicted here like? And this takes it out of the possibility of being premarital, you know, sexual experimentation or anything like that. What are the three aspects of love? It is self-giving. Okay, it is desirous. Okay, it desires that other individual, and it is zealous to protect the exclusivity of that relationship. We tell our children, you know, that jealousy is wrong in some contexts, but it is deadly correct. It is absolutely right in certain contexts. If my wife detects that another woman is after me, which I know is an improbable thing, or should I turn my eyes towards some other woman, she had better get jealous. And if she doesn't get jealous, that's a bad sign. And I as well with her. God is jealous for His people. It's not a negative thing in the right context. It's the right thing. So this love is self-giving. It is zealous to protect an exclusive relationship. It is desirous of that other individual, that one other individual. And what's the last? It's committed. These are all very important things. If love is not self-giving, then what is it? It's selfish. And one thing that is devastating, really, as you get older, as I am, and get to know, and particularly women talk about these things more than men, but as you get to know a little bit what's going on in other marriages, it's hard sometimes to hear how few really find fulfillment in their physical relationship in marriage. A lot of times it's because one or the other has acted in selfish ways, has not been understanding, has not been patient, has not been disciplined. A lot of times we think we need to discipline ourselves sexually until we get married, and then we can, you know, give vent to every urge as it occurs. That's not true. That's not a loving reaction to the other person. In Intimate Allies, this book, Allender and Longman say, "The route to intimacy is a paradox. We must care less for ourselves. We must care less about ourselves than we do for our spouse. If we enter a relationship to find someone who will increase our glory, then we will violate and drain that person's capacity to offer life." And sometimes you do see that selfishness, and then the frustration, and then just a mechanical relationship that takes place that is not at all fulfilling. So it needs to be self-giving. It needs to be desirous. And if it's not desirous, if a relationship is not desirous, if there's no animal magnetism left between a husband and a wife, that's an endangered situation. Now again, I don't want to overblow that, you know, like can't resist the guy, you know, you run across the room or anything. But there should be desire. Again, in Intimate Allies, Allender and Longman say, "In many ways, sexuality is a barometer of the weather of a marriage relationship. Marriage is far more than a sexual relationship, but it is not less. And sexuality and intimacy is one of the glues, not the only glue, but it's one of the glues that keeps a marriage together. Sexual dissatisfaction is a sensitive indicator that God's plan for marriage is off track." So it needs to be self-giving, it needs to be desirous. And if it's not committed, then it's condemned. It's condemned in two senses. It's condemned by God. Sexuality, sexual expression outside a committed monogamous marital relationship is wrong, according to Scripture. So it's condemned by God. But it's also condemned in the sense that a broken down building is condemned. If commitment is not there, then the fact that the curse is real and that we're all sinners and that no matter how perfect you may think that person you're marrying is before the wedding, maybe if you haven't dated very long or gotten to court very long, you will soon discover that you married, as indeed everyone else did, a sinner. And our sin will drive us apart. Our sin will drive all kinds of wedges between us if we are not committed. Because sometimes it's more tempting just to walk away than to work it out. And it's that commitment, resolve that this is going to work. I'm not walking out on this. We're going to talk this out. We're going to work this out. It's the commitment that is the glue. I said the sexual intimacy is one of the glues. The commitment is the fundamental glue that holds that relationship together. And out of that commitment, then all the feelings and the romance and so forth does grow and flourish. So self-giving love, desire, commitment. The Song of Songs has much to teach us about human relationships. Does it teach us something about theology? Is this a book devoid of theology? Well, what does Webb say? Yes, in a reflective sort of way, it does. If we outline these three aspects of love, self-giving, desirous, committed, those are reflections of God's love for us. We don't often think about the fact that God desires us, that He has drawn to His people in that way. It's an astonishing thought, really. And I don't think it's appropriate to think in sexual terms per se, but in a certain way, though, that kind of draw, that kind of drive toward that other person is part of God's desire for His people. And the people of God are described as the bride of Christ, and in the Old Testament as God's wife. Webb concludes this way, "The Song of Songs looks back to the gift of love in Eden and on to the perfection of love in heaven when, as the bride of Christ, the church will be united with Him forever. In marriage, by God's grace, we may experience again the goodness of the gift once given and enjoy a taste of the perfection that is yet to come." I would encourage us all to take seriously our relationships, particularly with that one other person, and be a little more open about the joys of marital life with our world, so that they don't walk away thinking, man, those Christians have sacrificed the best things in life. Hollywood kind of tends to set the pace of what love, marriage, and divorce is all about, particularly the latter. We need to be exemplary in this fashion. And we also need to be very careful in the way we deal with our children and the way we deal with other people in terms of we're so intent on forbidding and safeguarding children from wrongful sexual expression prior to marriage that we could tend to be heard. Now, we wouldn't say it this way, but we're heard, sex is bad. Sex is bad, you know. And we need to be telling them, you know, and it's embarrassing to tell your own children this, you know, sex is great in the right place. You know, when I was a seminary student, I heard people do practice sermons, as we do here. They're not really practice because you're preaching to your fellow students. But this guy was to do an evangelistic sermon, and particularly he chose to preach the evils of alcohol and smoking, I guess. Must have been something of a legalistic background. And sex, you know, and it just undifferentiated. And afterwards, I went up to him and I said, that was a very powerful message. You know, I've been married for 5 years now, and you know, I've been engaging in sex, and your condemnation of sex makes me want to repent and stop. You know, I think you got my point. You know, you've got to differentiate it. It's illicit sex, it's inappropriate sex.